People should take culture into account from the beginning of the project. What you don't want to do is you want the project and it fails, and then you're kind of exposed like, oh, was that because of culture? Because then it's very difficult at that stage to really investigate that.
Welcome to Vox Dev Talks. My name is Tim Phillips. How does culture affect development policy, and how does development policy affect culture? If we don't take account of cultural norms, or we fail to learn about how they interact with well-intentioned policies, then this gap in our knowledge, well, it might be undermining otherwise well-structured development projects. A new paper investigates what we know about culture, policy, and economic development and their interaction. Natalie Bao of UCLA, Sarah Lowes of UC San Diego, and Eduardo Montero of the University of Chicago are the authors. And we have all three of them joining me now, full house. Natalie, welcome back to Vox Dev Talks.
Nice to see you again, Tim.
Sarah, welcome.
Thank you. Good to be here.
And Eduardo as well, welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for the invitation.
Natalie, why did you write this review?
Well, there's a new handbook of cultural economics coming out, and Sarah, Eduardo, and I were asked to write this chapter, so we almost didn't have a choice.
That's a motivation of a sort, isn't it? When we talk about culture in this context, what do we actually mean? What does the word mean?
This is a tricky question. I feel like I should make Sarah or Eduardo answer this one.
Yeah, so by culture, we generally mean the values and beliefs that are socially transmitted across generations. But to give more concrete examples, say, for example, from Natalie's work, sometimes that'll mean practices like what types of payments are made when people get married? Like, are there transfers of money between, say, the groom's family and the bride's family? So that's one Natalie studied, bride price, for example. But there's lots of examples we can think about. So like generalized trust. Do you trust other individuals? Do you think it's the right thing to do?
Economists can think about culture in a lot of different ways. It could be something that determines the rules of the game and how people interact, because you might face social sanctions if you don't follow certain norms. It could be like a heuristic people use in decision making, right? Whereas it's, you know, cognitively complex to like work out the best option every time, or you may not have all the information, but over time, some kind of heuristic has evolved and been passed down that you could use to make decisions. It could be something that involves your beliefs or attitudes. So what I really like about the definition Sarah gave is it's pretty broad. It allows for kind of all the richness of how culture can affect decision making.
In the context of development policy, when we think about culture, we really want to think about how culture is shaping incentives. So what are the payoffs associated with different types of choices individuals are making?
Yeah, absolutely.
Given the fact that it is a fairly broad definition, how do you recognize what is culture? How can we measure culture?
A lot of economists in the past used to think about culture being very soft, it's like fuzzy, what do we know what it is? Whereas economists, we like rigorous things that we can measure. I think in the last few decades, economists have gotten much better about measuring culture and thinking about how to get micro data on it. So there's things like survey questions where you ask people, do you trust others? There's downsides to that. So Sarah has done a lot of work with lab in the field experiments, trying to use behavioral games to measure people in the field. How do they react under different choice sets? And then there's also now like extremely good ethnographic data as well about societies from anthropologists that economists have started using a lot more. And so I think in the last few years, economists have gotten much better about rigorously measuring culture and thinking about how do you, you know, put culture into data, fit it into our econometric models.
And I would add that we're lucky that anthropologists and sociologists have been thinking about this for a pretty long time. Mm-hmm. And so economics tends to be quite imperialistic. We don't have to reinvent the wheel here, and we can learn a lot from what these other fields have thought about in terms of how to measure and think about culture.
Does that cultural imperialism mean that economists have either ignored or undervalued the influence of culture in the past?
I think like the past 20 years, there's been a lot of growth and excitement about understanding the role of culture. Culture historically was something that was hard to measure. And also, it was seen this way, maybe not that linguist, because it was a little bit residual. It's like, well, we can't explain why something is happening, so let's blame it on culture. Economists don't like that. Like, you don't want an explanation that's just like, it's the residual, you just go to it, can explain everything. And so I think for a long time, people shied away from culture because of that. But I think the existence of better and better micro data and more influence from measurement and anthropology has really led to this resurgence.
You know, quite an ingenious way to demonstrate that the understanding of culture is important for policy effectiveness. Tell me a little bit about this and explain what you did and why you did it.
We begin the chapter by trying to motivate why we should care about the intersection of culture and policy. And we use some data on the World Bank and projects that are implemented by the World Bank, and then evaluations that the World Bank does of these projects and how effective they are. The logic was, can we use this data to provide some stylized facts about culture potentially mattering for the efficacy of policy? As part of this exercise, we identify project team leads. So the individuals who are in charge of these World Bank projects, you have an individual who's from the place where a project is being implemented. Is that project more successful? And we do find some evidence that if individuals happen to be from the place where the project is being implemented, the projects get higher outcome ratings. Now, of course, this is purely correlational evidence. There's no identification strategy. There's no randomization of task team leads to the projects that are being implemented. You have to interpret these data with a bit of caution. But the way we were thinking about it is that individuals bring location-specific knowledge to projects when they are being implemented in their country of origin. And this could potentially facilitate better project outcomes. Now, just in defense of the World Bank and the types of management strategies they have, there's obviously really good reasons why you might not assign someone who's from the place where a project is being implemented.
Well, exactly, because after I read what you'd done, I went and looked this up. Now, there are good reasons, aren't they?
So the primary reason is that you might just want to prevent any sort of appearance of or ability to have any corrupt or non-objective types of decision-making.
There's like logic behind it too, which is the World Bank was afraid of the potential of local capture. You can think about it. If you're from the country, maybe you'll favor certain people from your country, home country. There'll be more potential for nepotism. This is definitely something that we should be worried about. A lot of work has been going into things like this in the past, historically in political economy and development. So there's very valid reasons for it. I think there were other reasons too. Like, there's a potential for learning about different contexts if you're rotated across different places. I think we've all learned from working in different contexts as well. So there's a value, but you want to balance these two potentially. For example, if you made us all work in a new place, a totally different place, the first year we'd probably struggle because we'd have to really understand the local norms, the culture, who to work with, who we can trust. And so there's pros and cons. Just like as economists working in different contexts, we learn a lot, but there's also challenges. The same thing could be true for these World Bank team leaders. There's value of like knowing a place, being familiar with the culture. Maybe you can implement projects a bit better, design them better. And so like a lot of things in economics, there's these trade-offs.
And this is not exclusive to the World Bank. Many, even internally to countries, many civil services are designed this way where people are deliberately not assigned to their home location, or maybe even rotate every few years. And I think so, as Eduardo says, this really points to kind of the trade-offs. Maybe you assign someone somewhere else because you're worried about the existing networks. Now you rotate them every 3 years. It's just as soon as they begin to warm the local culture, they'll rotate it out to somewhere else.
Reading your review, it's very obvious that now we do have quite a few pieces of evidence that policy has been less effective, often because of the influence of culture, or because it did not take account of the influence of culture. Could you give me some examples of this?
Well, I think there have been a lot of cases where policies have had unintended consequences because of failure to think about culture. And so that doesn't necessarily mean it's not effective at one goal, but it may have a consequence that isn't intended at the same time and could even be negative. An example from my own work comes from pension plans in low-income countries. I've studied the rollout of pension plans in Indonesia and Ghana. We think of pension plans as kind of a fairly important modernization policy, especially as people are starting to rely less on their kids for old age support. Often the welfare state needs to kind of step in to provide that. But what I've shown in my work is that when you had these kind of existing kinship traditions where certain children would take care of the parents in the old age. The traditions I work out, matriarchality, where daughters take care of parents and patriarchality, where sons take care of parents. Those traditions actually were incentivizing parents to educate those kids because they saw more the returns of those educational investments. When you put in the pension plans, you know, actually reduced the likelihood that kids would stay with their parents and take care of them. You can kind of argue about whether this was kind of a good or bad consequence. This is a complicated effect. But on top of that, it also reduced the incentive to educate those kids. The relative education rates of the daughters fell in the cultural groups where daughters took care of parents, and the relative education rates of sons fell in the cultural groups where sons took care of parents. The policy may have been effective. It did provide more old age support. At the same time, it crowded out a lot of the old age support that was previously going on from children, and it also maybe reduced educational investment at a time when probably these growing countries really wanted to increase educational investment. You want to talk about lock boxes, Sarah? I think this is like kind of one of my favorite ineffective policies.
Yes, I'm happy to talk about this. So this is an RCT that was implemented among a group that sort of was pretty remote, autarkic, so not well integrated into markets, so the Chimane. And the goal was to increase savings. So they provide these individuals in these villages with access to lock boxes to put their savings in. Mm-hmm. And so perhaps surprisingly, they find that when individuals have these lock boxes, the effect is that they actually have an increase in alcohol consumption. And that was, I think, puzzling to the researchers. Right. That was not obviously the reason why they implemented
it's
this.
Puzzling to me, yeah.
So they brought on an anthropologist who had a, you know, a pretty deep knowledge of the setting. And in the setting where people aren't integrated into markets, the only use that people had for money was to purchase alcohol. So it was a pretty perhaps expected outcome given the cultural setting. The anthropologist was able to explain to the economists why they are finding these otherwise unexpected outcomes.
Incredible. Eduardo, do you have an example for me?
Sarah and I have this paper about colonial medical health campaigns and their long-term consequences. In former French colonies in Central Africa, the government went around trying to control sleeping sickness. Basically, people in villages were forced to submit to blood tests and often forced treatments using medicine that was very ineffective. This is from 1920 to around 1956. And so in the long run, we find evidence that these places mistrust medicine more. But I think if you hadn't had this understanding of the history of a place, the culture, it'd be very easy to be like, people here aren't interested in health or vaccines or other things like that. And we even show that World Bank health projects, speaking of them again, are less effective in these areas, health ones specifically, not so much other World Bank projects. That's an example of policies today are less effective because of a history that created a culture of mistrust in medicine. But maybe once we understand the history and the culture, we might design different health interventions or have different standards for what's a successful intervention or not. Anthropologists had highlighted these colonial campaigns just really affected people's views on medicine today in parts of the world. And so what we did in that paper is gather some archival data from where these campaigns happened and study how did that impact things like if you're offered a free blood test from the DHS data, do you refuse it or not? And we find places that had more of the history of these colonial campaigns, we find these places are more likely to refuse free blood tests and have fewer vaccinations today.
And there have been some pretty extreme examples of vaccine campaigns in places like Nigeria, where people have literally hidden their daughters or people have fled to avoid the vaccines because they're so convinced that these vaccines, you know, for example, cause sterility or have other negative health consequences. So this is a very serious health problem.
Now, another aspect of this that I must have talked to many, many people, many episodes of Vox Dev Talks have been concerned with this, where you have a successful RCT, you try and scale it up. It is unsuccessful. When you look more closely at it, then some cultural differences in the areas to which you're trying to scale it up make a big difference. What are the examples of this?
Just going back to the example Sarah brought up about the lockboxes, that's a really interesting example because in other contexts, it had been found to be a very effective way of first increasing savings, of course, through the lockboxes, but then on subsequent other investment in assets and incomes in other contexts. So that's an example where the same policy, such a simple policy like giving people lockboxes, had been shown to be effective in other contexts. But when you do it in a context like in rural parts of Bolivia, you find very different effects.
Another good example, I think, are unconditional cash transfers. So there's a lot of really excellent evidence that they're really effective at alleviating poverty, especially in the short run. But in our chapter, we cover some examples from Kenya where actually communities actively resisted receiving free money, which I think is puzzling for many people if you were to just hear like, hey, would you like $1,000? I think the answer is often, yes, please. Sure. But in this case in Kenya, people were actually like, no, we don't want to participate in this. And the evidence suggests that part of that resistance comes from the way reciprocity is understood in this context, that you can't receive things for free. That just didn't culturally resonate with people. And in fact, was actually really suspicious. And so rather than participate in something that was suspicious to them and potentially like malevolent because it didn't meld well with the culture, people refused free money.
Can we think about this as a positive, the understanding of culture and how with a deep understanding of culture, then interventions or policies can become even more effective or work quicker or have spillover effects that maybe wouldn't have been thought of in the original design?
So I think this is one of the new frontiers in cultural economics. Mm-hmm. And so I think as economists are increasingly thinking about how do you like take culture into account in policy design or leverage existing cultural practices. Going back to the example Eduardo and Sarah were talking about of there being huge amounts of medical distrust in sub-Saharan Africa, and actually a lot of that kind of manifests in a feel that interventions will cause sterility. I have some work looking at the why young women don't take up contraceptives in sub-Saharan Africa, even though they are often having a lot of unprotected sex. And even if they're actively engaged in no education, and so they may be forced to drop out or to kind of have their lives derailed by unplanned pregnancies. And what we saw in focus groups is that there was this tremendous fear that these modern contraceptive methods cause infertility. And so we actually designed a treatment to exactly target that medical distrust. And we were able to increase contraceptive take-up rates by about 30 to 40% in that population.
So let's finish up by looking at what you were calling the new frontier, Natalie. And one positive thing is that we are learning from, we can call them these failures, the results that aren't as good as we hoped that they would be. But how can we make sure we do learn from them? Because very often they don't get published and they don't get publicized.
Tim, you raise an important problem. We can't learn from things we don't know about. So I think the first order thing is that when projects are unsuccessful, when they face problems, it should be something that's publicly documented or available to researchers, available to policymakers, because without that information, without that data, it's just a missed opportunity to learn what went wrong, what went well, how do we improve in the future? And that's a bigger problem than I think we can solve today, but it certainly suggests that, you know, one path forward is making sure this data and information are available to people who are interested.
As you were mentioning, Tim, the file draw problem is a really serious issue. Mm-hmm. There's been some argument that when people do LCTs, maybe it's less likely to occult simply because of the time and money involved. But, you know, our obvious recommendation to researchers is that all projects, even if the no results, should be published. And ideally, journals should be interested in publishing interesting no results. People should take culture into account from the beginning of the project. What you don't want to do is you want the project and it fails, and then you're kind of exposed like, oh, was that because of culture? Because then it's very difficult at that stage to really investigate that. And so we have a series of recommendations. One is to talk to anthropologists very early on to think about what elements of the cultural context might matter. I think also doing your own focus groups and embedding yourself in the context are really important. If you're doing, for example, your own RCT, and that was to kind of design the intervention itself with the idea that culture may be important, that could be stratifying along certain cultural characteristics. And, you know, Sarah has some work where they do that when they were looking at aid sets. It could also mean making sure that you collect the data on the relevant cultural practices so that you're not like, oh, was it cultural? Later on, you actually can test those hypotheses. So I think those series of ways to have more cultural conscious design. And I think also it's important to recognize that cultural conscious design does not mean just interacting in intervention with some existing cultural traditions, saying, oh, I see some statistically significant result. We want to understand why that intervention interacts with those characteristics and whether that's likely to be externally valid to other settings. And so it's important to think about why those characteristics are changing incentives, how we can separate the effects of whatever observed cultural characteristic from admitted variables that may be correlated with that cultural characteristic. And so I think all of this requires very careful design thinking from early on in the project.
A common response I get to this chapter is that, oh, you expect us to take into account every potential cultural trait in a setting and build policy with all of this deeply, deeply local knowledge. Doesn't that seem impossible? An easy way to begin this process, a lot of development researchers and policymakers already do this, is having local collaboration, people from the context who really understand well what's happening.
Is it easy to find people to work with from other disciplines? How do you do that? Economics, as you mentioned at the beginning, Natalie, maybe hasn't had the best record of looking outside its own discipline. Is it obvious who to consult with?
I think interdisciplinary collaborations can be pretty challenging, particularly because the publication, like expectations and standards, are really different across fields. So even if you find somebody who, you know, you work with very well and you could do amazing work with, you know, they may not be interested in trying to spend 6 years or 7 years trying to publish in a top economics journal, right, which is pretty standard within economics. One example is this project called Moving to Opportunity, where they looked at what happened when you gave households, very poor households, vouchers to move to higher income neighborhoods. It turns out there were very big positive long-run effects on the kids, but they initially didn't see much positive effect on their parents. And so to try and understand that, they actually brought in some qualitative sociologists who did like very in-depth interviews with the households and were able to provide some explanations, being able to understand why this was happening. But I think even short of that, just presenting to interdisciplinary audiences, like talking to people who are experts in certain areas, reading the relevant literature, I think all of this can lead to like much more informed research. And I think often people are very happy to talk about things. I've recently been doing some work on DALI, and I cold emailed some anthropologists, and I said, this is what we're working on. I don't know if you think it's crazy, but I would like to know if you think it's crazy. Can we just talk for like half an hour on the phone, you know? That's really valuable. And then also those conversations can turn into collaborations, you know, in the long run. And I think there's also some like kind of natural ways of collaborations to occur. In economics, we do a lot of focus groups, all version of qualitative research, and that never is in the papers. We do it to inform our intervention, to inform what data to collect, but we never think about trying to publish that. And actually, I was talking to a sociologist we're working with in Zambia, and he said, you did all these really interesting interviews. I'm an ethnographer. Why don't we just do a couple more interviews and I can write this up as a paper? So I think there's already ways that we could nest more interdisciplinary work and also gain a lot from people who know a lot more about how to do that qualitative work, just within our natural process that already exists.
Okay, just to sum this one up, how much do we still not know? What do we need to find out to be able to help our practice in this area?
The short answer is there's a lot we don't know. This was one of the shorter chapters I've written because it turns out there's a lot still left to explore. I'll start with one recommendation that I think Natalie's already hinted at a few times, which is that we need better data on cultural practice. So a lot of the work on culture relies on these really excellent, but now maybe perhaps dated ethnographies that were collected during the colonial era. We can probably do better than that now. So thinking about how we can systematically document cultural practices, both at a point in time, but also across time, because obviously culture is changing and it's not a static thing. And our data so far are not great at capturing that.
A lot of the work we do relies on the ethnographic atlas, which is kind of a static point in time. And not actually the same point in time for the country. We mostly ignore that. We've gotten very little work on the dynamics of culture because we often don't have multiple measures over time for most cultural variables. And a lot of that information does potentially exist in anthropology, but would just need to be codified. I think there are some people maybe think about working on this already, but I think that would be kind of an exciting direction. And also thinking about nesting more cultural variables on existing data that's being collected and kind of at repeated points over time. I think part of the reason we have relatively more work on certain things like polygyny is because those cultural variables were in the demographic and health surveys. And so people actually could use existing data to look at that. Unfortunately, the direction things are moving in, we may actually be getting less of those types of data sets. Hopefully in the future for the data sets that continue to be collected, a broader set of cultural variables could be nested in those existing data collection efforts.
Good luck doing the rest of the research. Natalie, thank you very much.
Thanks.
Sarah?
Thank you.
Eduardo as well.
Thank you very much.
The paper is called Culture, Policy and Economic Development. Authors you heard from all three of them, Natalie Bao, Sarah Lowes, and Eduardo Montero. This has been a Vox Dev Talk, the best way to make sure you don't miss an episode. Follow us or subscribe. You find us wherever you get your podcasts. All our past episodes are at voxdev.org. You will also find articles at voxdev.org about all the topics that we feature. There's quite a lot about this, I know that. And remember, if you like what you're hearing, tell someone else about us. Go on, leave us a review as well. Vox Dev Talks is a Talk Normal production. The assistant producer is Megan Bieber and our editor is Andrei Zargarian. Thanks to Oliver Hanni and Iman Siddiq at Vox Dev.